Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. Visit speakuptalkradio.com. And today we have an author who says, holding a book in your hands is like carrying around a piece of another person's brain, but far less messy and creepy and illegal. He is Nicholas Adams. Nicholas grew up in a small rural town of Boring, Oregon, with his six brothers and sisters. And after graduating from high school in Gresham, Oregon, he attended Brigham Young University, Idaho, and received his associate's degree in pre-med. From there, he returned to Portland, Oregon, and attended Portland State University, where he earned his bachelor's degree in biology, pre-med, before changing his career track to architecture. He completed his second bachelor's degree in architecture at Portland State University before going on to achieve his master's of architecture degree from the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. After his graduation, he and his wife moved to the Phoenix, Arizona area, where they adopted four children over the next 8 years. Nicholas currently lives in the Salt Lake City area, where he is an associate member of the American Institute of Architects. His other interests include reading, video games, singing, and motorcycles. His dream is to become a Golden Pen recipient of the Writers of the Future contest. And if his debut novel, Avenging Angels, the first in the Seraphim Chronicles, is any indication, he is well on his way. And I want to get on my way with today's conversation, so welcome to the show, Nicholas.
Thank you, Pat. Great to be here.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you here. And there's just so much to talk about before we get to your book. I love that you grew up in a town called Boring, because you're obviously nothing.
Oh, I don't know. Some people do say I'm not the most exciting person.
Oh, no. Well, given all the diverse background you have, I would say that you are not boring. And I'm actually quite interested for you to share just a little bit about your adoption of four children. What was that process like?
So my wife and I, we got married a little bit later than normal. I was almost 33. She was 29. Shortly after we got married and several failed attempts to have our own kids, we found out that we just, for whatever reason, just couldn't have our own. We really wanted to have kids in the house, so we started doing foster care in Arizona. There's a huge need for it. And so we started taking little kids that were mostly from neglected families and started taking care of them until they went back home. And in the process, this four kids, one by one, came along that became adoptable, that just became ours. And we went through all of the adoption proceedings, one by one, collecting our kids. And now we have two beautiful girls and two wonderful little boys, and they are just the apples of my eye.
Oh, isn't that a beautiful story? And I have a home in Arizona as well, and found that to be true. It seemed like there was a great need.
Yeah, there really is. I mean, of all the states I've lived, that's the one where if there is a family out there that just wants to help give kids a safe place, mm-hmm. even if it's temporary, Arizona has a great need for foster families.
Yeah, well, bless you for doing that. And you've been blessed by doing that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a privilege, and we have our four kids.
Yep. No, I understand that. I get it. So how does a person with a master's in architecture come to write sci-fi fantasy fiction?
Oh, I grew up as a total nerd my entire life. I grew up on Star Wars and Star Trek and Dune and just, all the nerd sci-fi classics, and just love the idea of other worlds and exploration and that whole, not the fantasy, like fairy genre, but just the sci-fi fantasy. And it was just always my favorite daydream, is to create a world of my own where I could, control the characters and live out adventurous stories, because I never really considered myself to be adventurous. So I would live out my adventures in my mind. And just one day I just kind of thought, I'm tired of waiting around for someone to write my favorite story, so I just decided to start typing it.
That's exciting that you felt that and actually took action.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what is it like to balance a full-time job? You're an architect?
I'm not a licensed architect. I do have to make that clarification. Legally, I cannot tell people I'm an architect. but I have been working in architecture for about 17 years.
Okay. So you do that, you have a family, and you still find time to be fresh and creative and write. How do you manage that?
Usually I give myself about an hour and a half early in the morning. I found that that's really the only time I have for myself to write. Is I have to get up at 5 in the morning, come down to my office early where no one's here. That's when I'm freshest, and then I can, you know, work for about an hour, hour and a half, and maybe get several paragraphs to maybe a page down of, you know, a good continuation of the whatever stories I'm currently working on. Because, you know, then at 8 o'clock, then my life belongs to my boss. And then when I get home, my life belongs to my family. And then by the end of the night, I'm just too tired to try and do any more writing. So I really have to do it in the morning when I actually have the creative juices flowing.
Do you set an alarm, or do you feel compelled and impelled to just jump up in the morning and get started?
Oh, I have to have an alarm.
Okay.
4 little kids under the age of 9, I'm just exhausted. So I have to set an alarm.
I bet there's times, though, that you get so into your writing that you realize, oh my gosh, it's 8 o'clock and I don't want to leave.
Oh, yeah, there have actually been times where I've had an inspiration in the middle of the day, and I just had to get it down, and I would just be like typing it over lunch, and then my boss will come over. He's like, "What are you working on?" just had to get the story down really quick. Just 2 more paragraphs. I had to get back to work.
So they're sympathetic to the fact that they are working with an author as well.
They do try and, you know, be understanding. And I also try and give them that extra effort, you know, because I have to travel to do training sometimes. So it is a balance, and, you know, I try not to make it an issue, but, you know, sometimes when you have that flash of inspiration, if you can't just make some notes, like if it's a full conversation, that you just you have to get it down when it's fresh, otherwise you lose it.
Yep. That happens quite often in the middle of the night where you've got this genius idea, and then in the morning you have no idea what it was.
Yeah, totally. I actually had one of those just the other day.
Oh, that is really frustrating, where you wake and you realize that there was something awesome going on and there's no way you can pull it back.
Yeah.
Now, why did you decide to use a pen name?
Well, initially, I think it was because I was afraid that if my book really tanked, or if it was horrible, then there was that layer of separation, a little bit of anonymity. And on the opposite side, that if it did do really well, there was still that layer of anonymity of, I'm a very private person, so I kind of wanted to keep my personal life and my writing life, have some separation between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I just really like the way Nicholas Adams, you know, rolls off the tongue.
I agree. Well, now, give us a synopsis of your book, Avenging Angels.
Okay, so it's set in the distant future. Humanity has gone through a global collapse, and they've finally rebuilt up to a high level of technology. And there is the high technology people that love all the fanciest gadgets, they pushing the limits of technology, and then there's the low technology people. That's more like, you know, the farmers and the people that want to live a simple life. They don't want to do all that high-tech stuff that led to humanity's demise. And in the midst of this, a race called the Angels, that's what they're dubbed, comes from outer space saying, oh, we've left our world that's tearing itself apart. We just want to live and serve. And they become integrated into human society. And nobody really notices, but they're essentially a slave class, and even though they're very willing and benign about it, only the low technology people seem to distrust them because they're too much of a good thing. If there's a disaster, they're the first ones in to help. They donate organs and body parts for people that are suffering or just for vanity's sake. I talk about that in my book, that there are those that love the angels so much that they replace their own skin with angelic skin because they want to be that pure white. So it's, for me, it's this take on, it's a different take on slavery, where instead of it being you're capturing people, the angels, at the risk of doing a giveaway, are not what they seem. I don't want to give a spoiler.
No, you don't want any spoilers here.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil it, but the angels are not what they seem. Mm-hmm. And my protagonist, Evangeline, she discovers a secret that her parents discovered before her. And so it's her life revolving around just living in this world and what happens when you discover the truth and what do you do about it.
Mm-hmm. Was it difficult making a female the protagonist?
There were certain aspects of it that were challenging. Just given my nature, I'm just more of a sensitive person. I'm not a manly man by any stretch of the imagination. So I've always been able to relate to women better than men. That was one way that enabled me to write a strong female character. And I've been told by some female fans that I did such a great job of getting into the head of a woman. Mm-hmm. But I also had a lot of help from my cousin Amy, who would, you know, she was one of my beta readers. And she'd, you know, give me some notes saying, oh, I don't think Evangeline would react to this situation, you know, the way you wrote it. I think she would have different motives for doing what she did. Mm-hmm. And so she helped me kind of rewrite of how a woman would react versus how I think a woman would.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Two different things. Yeah. Well, now you wrote, I believe fiction writers are the most honest of liars. They expose their innermost thoughts through fiction. So what were your innermost thoughts telling you as you came up for the premise of this book, Avenging Angels?
Wow. I've never been asked that question. I mean, well, I wrote that quote just because, you know, when you're writing, you're investing so much of yourself into what you're saying that your beliefs, your true nature is visible under the surface. But as far as the premise of the book, originally, honestly, it started out as space vampires.
Okay.
Vampires from space. And it just, over the years of just playing in this world, it just evolved until eventually I really started having a very strong belief of how insidious we can become slaves to technology or enslaved to debt. And it's all by our own choice. We're willingly entering in these contracts and giving up our freedom and our own logical self-thought for something that's being handed to us. And I think that's kind of how it evolved to what it is now, that we are, you know, we're kind of becoming our own slaves to things that are really not important.
Yep. Yep. And this is precisely, the premise of your book is precisely, this is what attracted me to you, because I feel the same way as far as heading for a global collapse, because people are enslaved to technology. You can't even have conversations with people anymore. Everyone is just so glued to their technology and their cell phones, and everything's got to be fast, and people can't even stand the sound of their heartbeats and silence and quiet. I mean, everything has to be so technologically attached to them that they're no longer who they are.
Oh, I totally agree. I heard of an experience where there were two young men in church standing side by side. They're both on their phones, and their bishop or pastor walks by. He's like, oh, hey, who are you texting? And it turns out they were texting each other.
Yeah.
Standing side by side. Yeah. And even in my own home, my wife and I are sitting there on the couch, and the kids are in bed, and we're having our quiet time, and she's over on one end of the couch playing a word game. I'm on the other end of the couch playing a word game. I may be, you know, scratching her leg in the middle, but we're still in the same room, but there's still times when we're not actually together.
Yep. No, I agree. Like I said, that's what attracted me to you, was that I thought, wow, this sounds like somebody who gets it here. A lot of times I walk around feeling embarrassed for humanity when I see what's going on. So,
we're chained to our iPhones.
Yep. It's pretty sad. And I don't know how we're going to get out of it.
I think it's just a matter of being conscious about it. I mean, technology, it is just a tool. Just like a hammer at one time, it was still just a tool. It didn't define people. It was just how you use it.
Mm-hmm.
And it does take self-control to put it down and interact with those around you. I mean, there's been many techniques I've heard, like, you know, you're at dinner with friends, everybody puts their phone in the middle. Whoever grabs for their phone first pays for dinner.
So there's
incentives, but really, it all comes down, I think, to just self-control.
Yeah.
Is, are you willing to control the world around you and what interacts with you? Are you going to let what's around you control your actions?
Good conversation. I hope people take this to heart. Now, in the book Avenging Angels, there was a disease that affected everyone, yes?
Yes.
Now, did you draw on your knowledge as a pre-med student to create this or to come up with that?
Sort of. I mean, my pre-med background definitely played a role in how I approached the biology and the technology, but I think the disease itself, I did do some research, but I pretty much made most of it up.
Mm-hmm.
But how it affected the people, the ones suffering from it, I definitely never would have been able to make it up. I did have to know something about
mm-hmm.
communicable diseases and how they're spread and why they affect the body in certain ways.
Right. I figured as much. Well, now share your process when it comes to character development. So many people tell me that they begin to flesh out a character and then this character kind of takes on a life of its own and just takes off. Does that happen to you, or are you in control of what happens? I know you said your cousin Amy helps you, but as far as the character, are they on their own or do you rein them in?
Oh, no, they definitely create a life of their own. I've only written a few short stories along with this novel, but as I was writing the novel and I was introducing new characters, I did have to decide, you know, is this character going to stick around? If not, I really don't need to invest much in their personality. They can just kind of be an Olympian drone or just some low-tech zone guy. But if they were going to stick around, like one of my favorite characters is Derek Campbell. He's not the bad guy, but I think he's one of the most insidious in my story. He really just kind of took off in a direction I didn't initially anticipate, and he became he took on a larger role than I originally had planned for him, just because of how deliciously evil he was. And just his total, he lives in the shadows and he loves secrets and he's very good at learning other people's secrets and not revealing his own. And he really took on a whole new level that I didn't originally foresee.
I always find that so fascinating that these people take off on their own. So with that in mind, how do you know when the book is done? I mean, are these characters, if they're not finished, how do you know, okay, done with that book?
Well, for Avenging Angels, I knew in my mind, because I'd been daydreaming this world for 10 years, and when I decided to start writing the book, I knew how I wanted this story to open, and I knew how I wanted it to end. I just didn't know how I was going to connect A to Z.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I let the characters kind of lead me in this zigzag of where is the story going, weaving a lot of subplots and these other intangibles together until, all right, here's my pivot point. Now we've got to move in this one direction, and it's all about, you know, Evangeline against Olympus. But for the most part, they really just, I guess it's that old saying, I let the characters tell me where they wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times where I'd be writing along and I had a roadmap for where I wanted this scene to go. But then it's like, I'm writing, I'm like, oh, no, he wouldn't say that. He wouldn't be that way. You know, Campbell wouldn't be so nice to his subordinate. He would just be this ruthless jerk. And I had to totally backtrack and just, all right, how would he react? Then how would she react to that reaction? And just letting this chemical reaction happen and seeing where it ended up.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool. I love that process. And actually, I just interviewed someone right before you, and she kind of said the same thing. She said, I wrote the first chapter and I wrote the last chapter. And it was the in-between that I had to figure out how we were going to get from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, and I'm still learning the whole process. I mean, I've been reading Kim Weiland's book on outlining a novel? Because I know in other interviews you've done, you ask, do you prefer outlining or pantsing?
Mm-hmm.
And with Avenging Angels, it was definitely pantsing. I was just writing. I mean, in the first month, because it was a slow month, I wrote 80,000 words, my first draft, in 1 month. And then over the next 6 months, 8 months, however long it took me, I then added another, what is that, another 70,000 words to get to almost 150, because, you know, my cousin, my beta reader, is like, oh, you need more information here. I don't understand what's going on there. You're telling, not showing. But I was definitely pantsing that first novel, and now after reading this book on outlining, I realized, okay, I was doing most of my outlining in my head. I didn't formally write anything down, but I do have post-it notes everywhere. I get an idea of a character or how they need to behave or something that needs to happen in the future, and I would just write down post-it notes. So I've never really had a formal outline because it's always kind of been this, I just kind of know what I want to happen, and I just got to figure out how to get there.
Well, there's really no right way. I mean, everybody has to find their own way, and what's interesting is that maybe being an architect or studying architecture and where everything has to be exact, it's interesting then when you write that you're...
I fly by the seat of my pants.
Exactly. Very interesting. And that was leading me to my next question. Do you find any similarities between being an architect and being a writer?
Definitely, because you have the basic structure of a building. It has to have a skeleton. It has to have form. But with architecture, there also has to be beauty. I remember in school, before I, you know, went to architecture school, I just thought a building was, you know, four walls, floors, doors, windows. It just had to be functional. But really great stories, the function you don't really see as much as the beauty that pops out here and there. It's the small moments of delight, as we say in the architecture world, as you're going through a building. You come across an alcove that frames some city monument, you know, across the block, and you're like, wow, oh, this, all of a sudden this moment of, whoa, that's really cool. When the rest of the building you just kind of ignore because you're finding what you expect to see, walls, floors, ceilings.
I like that a lot. Small moment of delight. I'm going to think about that as I look at buildings from now on. Speaking of then small moment of delight, talk about your book cover design. How did that come about?
Well, this whole process, I've had no budget. I mean, literally, I've had absolutely no budget. Even when it came to my cousin doing my beta reading and a lot of editing for me, I was only able to pay her like $500. With a promise of, you know, more if the book ever took off, which it hasn't yet. So I'm still hoping to pay her more for all the work she put in. But the cover art, my younger brother is actually an industrial designer. And so he did the cover art. He's really good at, he was always the artist in the family and painting and drawing. So we sat down one night for like 2 hours and just, I talked to him about my concept of the Seraphim, that's what the vehicle is called, and just how I wanted it to behave and how I wanted it to look, and after a couple of iterations, that's what came out, and I just totally fell in love with it.
Yeah. I did too. It's very, very cool. And there's Evangelina at the bottom right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's walking toward the Seraphim.
Yep.
And I don't know if you noticed, but one of my favorite things about the cover is that the reflection on the floor from the Seraphim's flight wings, it's a hint of angel wings across her back.
Interesting. I'm going to have to take a better look at that. I'm not sure I saw that. Now, what publishing route did you take?
I self-published through CreateSpace.
Okay. And how did that go for you?
The process itself was very simple. I mean, it's really just a matter of uploading the files. And they have a lot of services, but like I said, I had no budget, so I had to do everything on my own. But they do have a lot of services. I got some critiques from friends, and once I published, I started doing some Goodreads giveaways, just trying to get some notoriety. So I've gotten a few really good reviews out of that. Not many, but all but one have been positive. Probably doesn't help so much that I'm also a control freak and had to have my thumb in every pie.
No, I get that as well. You're talking to one as well. Now, do you have any advice for other new authors?
Probably the same advice that was given to me. The best advice I got was find a writing group. Find a group of people mm-hmm. that are in a similar genre of you so that they understand where you're coming from. I'm in a great group. They're not all sci-fi fantasy writers. One is he writes books of old westerns. Another one writes kind of the occultish mystery. Another one is a writer artist, and he's got several books, but he's done so many things, mostly in the science fiction fantasy world, and then another mystery writer. But for me, that was just a great way to get advice from different points of view, not just from, oh, well, you know, if Gandalf walks into that room, he's got to have a staff in his right hand
mm-hmm.
kind of stuff.
Yeah.
More like the, you know, since I don't write your genre, maybe I just don't understand what you're trying to do. And so we have these great conversations of how to improve each other's work and things that, you know, they might say, like, because of my medical background, I'm able to comment on, you know, some of these murder mystery scenes
mm-hmm.
and just say, like, the blood isn't going to splatter on a 20-foot ceiling. It'll never get that far.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, being able to offer something instead of always getting the great advice as the newbie mm-hmm. is a good thing. But, you know, read books. I think I always enjoyed reading, but I spent so much time reading textbooks my whole life
yes.
that I never read for pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife, when we got married, she is the one that got me back into reading for pleasure with the Harry Potter books. And so now I try and read as much as I can because you get to see different styles and the way they handle different way of writing and approaching scenes. And it teaches me as well as entertains.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, you know, read more, read what you like. Read things that may be a little intimidating. Join a writer's group, and I keep telling myself this, but just write for fun.
Yeah.
Don't write to change the world, because who knows if what you write is going to change the world or not, but write for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm trying to do for me, is like, this is a hobby right now, and if it turns into a full-blown career and I get blessed with some success, then I still want to write for the people that like what I write, because, you know, they're my fans, and I don't know, I'm a people pleaser.
You're a good guy, and I think that was excellent advice, just to read more, connect with others, and write for yourself. Now, I have to ask you this. The picture on your site, I have no idea what you look like. Is that you with your hands covering your face?
Yes, it is.
And why did you do that?
Again, because of I want to have a
layer
of anonymity. And also, it's, you know, just kind of to add the mystery of, oh, who is Nicholas Adams?
I know, it's what I said.
I don't want people to look at it and be like, oh, I knew that guy in high school.
Oh, it's him.
Oh. Keep moving. Move along.
Oh, yes, don't want to read
move
that.
Along.
You're awesome. Well, what's next for Nicholas Adams?
I just submitted a short story to Writers of the Future for this quarter's contest. It's a short story about synthetic life and can we actually extend our lives into a synthetic body and what are the consequences of trying to do that.
Ooh.
I called it Imprint.
Oh.
And because of the way Writers of the Future works, I don't have to wait. I'm actually going to be publishing it with a cool cover that I designed in the next few days here.
Oh.
After that, I'm going to try and finish up another short story for the Writers of the Future called Leap, about a man who has a genetic trait that, along with a experimental drug, he is able to time travel, and he investigates crime scenes from the past.
Oh.
And he is going to be tied to a serial killer that is also a time traveler. And he has to figure out why his weapon is being used in all of these murders from the past when he's never done anything wrong.
Oh, my. Lots going on in your head.
I know. I have a very active imagination.
Please send me those when you're done. I'd love to read them.
Well, I'll have a imprint ready in the next day or two. I'd love to send you a copy.
Please do, yes. And we'll post more about that on your page on the website as well. I want to get that out there. Well, now, is there anything we missed that you would like to talk about today?
I guess I wrote Avenging Angels, I think, mostly for me, not really knowing if it was going to go anywhere. And it's just a really great sense of accomplishment that, you know, I was able to start and finish something so grand. Mm-hmm. Instead of just, you know, keeping my head down and putting my nose to the grindstone and all that. But, you know, this is a hobby that really is becoming a passion.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to learn how to do it better. And I listen to the advice of all the great authors because I want to be like them someday.
Oh. Well, I think you're on your way for sure.
Well, thank you.
I really do. Well, now, where can folks learn more about you and where can they purchase your book?
My book is listed on Amazon. I also have a website of the book itself. I don't have an author page. I'm working on that right now. But the seraphimchronicles.weebly.com is my book's website. I also have a Facebook page, Nicholas Adams, or maybe Nicholas P. Adams. And then there's also Facebook/the Seraphim Chronicles. The two pages are linked together, so if you find one, you can find the other. I'm also on Goodreads, and I love getting friend requests, and people following me as an author can be found there.
All right, so there's many places. The seraphimchronicles.weebly.com. You just Google Avenging Angels. So, folks, I encourage you, Nicholas P. Adams, this is somebody we need to keep our eye on. Get a copy of his book. Nicholas, you were a small moment of delight today, actually.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, thank you for being here and for sharing your book with us.
Oh, it was absolutely my pleasure. Pleasure, not pressure.
A little bit of pressure.
Yeah, it was a little bit of pressure. A little Freudian slip, I think.
We'll end on a good note. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Pat.